I would like you to turn to Psalm 19, please. It's one of my favorite of the Psalms. I want to look at it in a little different way than I normally have in the past. I'm going to be dealing with verses 1 through 11 this morning, and tonight I'm going to be dealing with 12 through 14. Two different complete types of messages. I have been doing a lot of reading lately in preparation for my Old Testament classes, particularly in some of the scientific theories of the creation of the cosmos. And I want to share with you out of some of the encouraging and interesting things that I think is a new trend. It's not really new, but it's new to me in modern physics and science. And I want to approach it this way. As I was saying to the young people this morning, how do we really know what God is like? Or I would rephrase that question to you. How do we know what is reality? What is real? What is imaginary? What is psychological? Where is the essence of our world, our being, our purpose found? Now, that is not an easy question, for we're bombarded in a lot of areas. It's been interesting to me. My children have moved away from home in a smaller town, moved to a larger cities, and they're starting to tell me about things they hear from people, concepts they picked up from fellow students and friends. It's new age to the core, and they have no ability to discern if that's good or bad. It's just, boy, this is interesting, isn't it? It scares me today, the philosophies that are out there. New Age is kind of like Islam in this sense. Islam would say Jesus is a true prophet of God. He's not just not the ultimate prophet of God. New Age would say Jesus was the avatar or incarnation of God for the 19th before centuries. But the new century is going to have a new incarnation of God. I think people in America are searching for something spiritual. It's the rise of Satanism. We see it all the time in the papers, and probably much more common than that. The ritual killing of animals, the kidnapping of children, the people killing themselves because of worship of the evil one. I see it in the rise of Eastern religions in the United States. The more and more building of worship centers, primarily Eastern in their focus. I see it on the current TV ads on the cable where it says, the American Indians have always been speaking. You have not been listening. Let us tell you our story. And their story is the worship of animism, of multiple spirits. Now, our day is so looking for something spiritual that we'll try everything and anything to find meaning and purpose in what seems to be a materialistic dead end in the West. It wasn't even until the 1800s that atheism was an intellectual possibility. It wasn't until some of the existential philosophers like Camus and Sartre began to come right up against it and say there is a real possibility that we're here by accident and that our life has no purpose whatsoever. A man had not really tried to face that option before that. And the cultural milieu of modern America are peoples going in a million different religious directions, seeking for purpose and meaning. Now, I'll tell you what that one thing that does say to me is the church has been a miserable failure at communicating the gospel account to our day. Yes, we hide inside these walls and things are wonderful in here, but really, are we impacting a world beyond our little groups? I think we are not. And that's the rise of this search for spirituality in so many quarters, world religions, New Age philosophies, spiritual experiences through drugs, and on the search goes. Well, I've got good news. I think that the God of reality is trying to speak to us. Now just stop. That's a radical statement. You mean when I look up into the night sky at a million stars, maybe a billion of them, light years upon light years beyond my mental ability to think that far or that long ago? How long did it take the light from that star to reach my eyes? Thousands of light years. Boggles my mind. But I think when I cry up into the night sky, is there anyone out there? Is there any purpose for my existence? Am I going anywhere? Does it make any difference that I live? How I live? I believe there's a voice that comes back and says, you are precious to me. I made you in my image and gave you dominion over all creation. I believe there's a voice that comes back. I believe not only that God is trying to speak to us, but that His heart's desire is that we hear and respond. Religion is not a difficult thing until we muddy the waters. There is a God. He has created. He is speaking, and He wants you to know Him. Now you say, well, Bob, that's easy for you to say. You're primarily speaking out of your culture and personal experience. You're primarily just mimicking what you've heard from others who are significant in your life. It's just basically your subconscious projecting what you wish was out there. But the truth of the matter is, you're just here by accident, like all the rest of the living forms on our planet at this time. Now, I think that from the last 100 years, certainly since the time of Darwin, that we have got into that all that is simply here by chance. It's small changes over huge periods of time, and we just happen to be the epitome right now of that process, which is moving on and will move beyond us someday. But I want you to know that there is some growing body of scientific, checkable, substantiated evidence that that's not the way it is. It's coming from a really surprising source. Psalm 19, verses 1 through 6, is what I would biblically call natural revelation. And basically, it's put in personified terms of the sun being a person that runs a race and all of that. It is in ancient metaphorical language, no question about that. It does personify the forces of nature, no question about that. But what it is saying is that God is speaking through creation, that He really is trying to say something about Himself through that which He has made. Theologians have always struggled with this and always been forced to admit that God is speaking through the natural order, because the question that haunts all of us is, what about those who have never heard the name of Jesus, never seen a Bible? In the history of humanity, what will God do with them? And it bothers us, and we grieve over it, and we worry about it. That's why I think in Romans 1 and 2, one of the basis that Paul says that we are responsible to God is because all of us have understood something about the Creator from the created. There's a real fight among scientists today, not just atheistic scientists, but among Christian scientists. And the fight is over the time element involved in creation. And we have not solved that. It's still a major problem. But let me take the view that the earth is very old and that the cosmos is in the billions of years. Let's just assume, just for the sake of argument, that that is valid. And that Genesis is primarily description of ages more than 24-hour days. Just for the sake of argument, I want to take that first. You've probably read in the paper and are familiar with the current scientific model of the Big Bang. The Big Bang is a premise that all matter was centralized and highly compressed, and that at some point that it exploded, and that seems to solve some of the problems that we see in our world, that all bodies seem to be accelerating in speed or decreasing in speed. And there have been all kind of companion theories about, well, this is the way the Hindu views the world, an oscillating universe. It expands, it collapses, it expands again. That's why Shiva is called the creator and destroyer of worlds. But the more scientific study we do on the mass of the universe, the more it seems like there's not enough mass to fall back together. Modern physics has pretty much tried through its study of the cosmos to begin to measure the size of planets and the size of universes and the size of all that. And it's amazing to me that those who have no stake in Christianity, no reason to make it say something it's not, are coming more and more to have to posit that this looks like a purposeful creation. And that all the evidence seems to point, if you take the red shift of stars and all that, and I grant you there's some question about the way we measure all that, it's rather tentative, as all science is, it's rather theoretical. But it looks like on the best evidence that we have from background radiation in the universe, from the red shift of stars, that the universe is still expanding at a certain rate. If you take that expansion as being true, that means it had to begin at some time. And if you measure that, even if you want to take the highest number, which is around 17 billion years old for the cosmos, 17 billion years, number one, there is a beginning. Time has a beginning. Matter must have a beginning. And the one thing that evolution cannot handle is a beginning. A beginning points toward a time when there was nothing here, and then it starts. However long that cycle may be. The more we go back, and the Big Bang is only the current model. There are different forms of it, but it's the current model. Even if that is the way that God did it, I want you to know there's more and more evidence accumulating that time and space and matter and all the rest has a beginning, which makes us think, I don't have endless time to get man here. You say, well, what does that mean to me? Well, you know, the more we're studying organic people, whether it be people or cells or algae or whatever, you are an absolutely unbelievably complex living creature. And to think that we just started from a random association of atoms in a primeval soup struck by lightning does not in any way possible describe the complexity of DNA and amino acids and all these huge compounds, these molecular structures that make up organic life. As long as atheistic science had time without beginning for the random chance to occur, well, it could have been if you have time immemorial in the past, but now that we have just so much time for the creation of the cosmos and much less time for the creation of the earth, all of those years required for the random chance, small adaptions, is not there anymore. I remember when I was a few years ago as a young college student, I remember how frustrating it was to me to look in the night sky and think of how large this Milky Way is and one of several just like it. And to wonder of all those stars out there and how far away they are and how many planets there could be out there that could be like mine. It's just obvious if there are millions of worlds just like this and you believe that life is forming by natural processes, there's got to be life out there somewhere. But the more science is looking at the complexity of the earth and the complexity of organisms, the more they're narrowing down the parameters that are required for life. And some of the most famous atheistic scientists are wondering if there is any planet that duplicates the complexity of parameters to allow for physical life anywhere in the cosmos. It looks like this planet, and I'm not a scientist, I'm a preacher. And what I do understand seems to be so revealing to me. And granted, I certainly don't understand it all, and I imagine many of you could explain it far better than I could. But it looks to me like the number of things that have to come together to give us our atmosphere, and to give us the right heat, and to give us the right gravitational pull, and to protect us from meteors. It looks like the orbit of Jupiter does, and all the other things to protect our world, to make it just the right atmosphere for human beings and animal life to exist. It's beyond the realm of possibility to think this just happened. And more people are saying there's got to be some kind of guiding mind behind the unbelievable probabilities required for a setting like this. Well, the Bible puts it very, very carefully. And I think what we got to quit doing is arguing over the how of creation. I am not in a fight with physical science. I want to tell you that right now. Now, when I say I'm not in a fight with physical science, I want you to really hear me. I think sometimes physical science, like dogmatic preachers, mistake theory and fact. And how many preachers have I met who've been willing to die over their theory of the creation of the earth, and they don't want to look at anything, theological or physical. They know how it happened because God told them in a dream. I think they ate hot sauce too late, but somehow they found out, and now everybody's wrong but them. Now, the scientists do the exact same thing, especially when their theory is at stake. What's happened with science ought to give us a warning. The same thing's happened in theology. We have thought it was this way, and then we learn more, and we've changed the model, and we've changed the model. See how fickle you are? Not fickle at all. The whole purpose is, I think the scientific method is, you look where the anomalies occur, you study that. If the anomalies don't fit the theory, you redo the theory. Science is always a theory to be tested. It never comes to the element of doctrine. Science has changed and changed and changed, and I'm not going to link into any scientific model of creation either. The Big Bang right now does point toward a creator. But science has changed this theory about every 20 years, the last number of times that I know. So it may change it again. I'm not staking my view of God on physical science, but I want to say this. I'm not in a fight with physical science either. I don't think God is hiding or tricking mankind. It is amazing to me that if I believe that we started with a couple in a garden, look what that couple, fallen though they may be, have done with that garden. Think of the discoveries that fallen man has made. We are awesome creatures. And we live like we're cruds and crumbs. Now, we're morally broken, and sometimes our great genius, we kill ourselves with it. But God made everything that is, the Bible says, to fellowship with us. I used to worry about the Bible being terra firma oriented. It looked like the earth was the center and everything else whirls around it. The more I started learning science, I began to say, we're a third-rate star. And this is not even the biggest planet. How can I say that my worldview focuses on such an insignificant little planet in such a huge cosmos? Oh, but suddenly, science begins to tell me how wonderfully organized, how unique, what kind of precise, complex parameters exist on this little planet around a third-rate star. And suddenly the theology of the Bible begins to make sense. What if this is a unique place? What if it is? What if all that we see from the Rocky Mountains to the Pacific Ocean to the rainforest is nothing more than a stage prepared for God and man to meet and fellowship? I challenge you, if you are not conversant with the trends in modern physics, I challenge you to start reading about it, because I think it'll amaze you how modern physics is backing off of the dogmatism of Darwinian evolution, and how the study of the stars and the way they're put together is pointing toward a creator, and how the studies in biology are teaching us the unbelievable complexity of the simplest organic life. Oh, I think the day of Christians looking like nerds is beginning to end, and some evidence that we thought might never come from this area is beginning to shine to any open-minded person really to look at the scientific facts available today. Well, I think it's exciting. And I'm going to continue to read. Now, what bothers me with all this is, when I look at my world, oh, I see the beautiful flower, and I love to raise koi and lotuses and water lilies in my backyard, and how I love them. But you know my fish eat one another? Do you know the stinking snakes come live in my fish pond and try to bite me when I try to get them out? Now, I bought those fish. What's that snake doing in there? The tooth and the claw of nature is red and cruel, and nature by itself is not a complete witness about God. If all I knew about God was nature, I'd get a bigger hammer, live high up on the cliff. It's got to be more than just nature. In verses 7 through 11, is this second aspect of revelation. We call it in theology special revelation. And it simply means that not only has God revealed himself in something of the creation, which the 20th century now has a unique witness to that no generation before ours really has, but we have a revelation in the scriptures. Now, it's not a perfect revelation in the sense that if all I had was the Old Testament, I would know God completely. Some of the Old Testament scares me as bad as the tooth and the claw. Yes, I certainly understand God and His holiness. I certainly understand God and His majesty. But it's not as clear where God is going with the revelation as it is with the new. I understand more of the fulfillment as I understand the new. Certainly God has spoken through Israel, and we are indebted for that witness. But God has spoken supremely in His Son, and we are indebted to that witness. God is still trying to speak to us. God is not saying, well, if you're really good and you're really intelligent and you're really part of the spiritually elite, I'll give you a little bit of information. I think God has been screaming to us from creation and screaming to us through His relationship with Abraham and his seed and screaming through us through Jesus and His friends. And yet we choose not to hear because we want to live our own selfish, self-centered, materialistic lives. No, we have a special book. And in a world with such relativity, in a world with so many opinions, in a world with where even ethics has become related to the situation, I want to tell you one of the most thrilling things about my faith in Christ is that it gives me some guidelines, some absolutes for life. I'm able to draw some lines, at least for me, from this book, whereby I can find meaning and purpose and ethics and wholeness in this life. And they have proven to be true. Notice for a minute what this psalmist says about special revelation. Here, primarily, God's relationship through Israel. The law of the Lord is perfect, blameless, restoring the soul. And look at the parallel. The testimony of the Lord is sure, I mean trustworthy, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right. They're a standard. They're a guideline. They're a measuring reed, rejoicing the heart. The commandments of the Lord are pure. I think the NIV says radiant here, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true. They are righteous altogether. They are more desirable than gold. Yes, than much fine gold. Sweeter than honey, the drippings of the honeycomb. Moreover, by them thy servant is warned. And in keeping them is great reward. Do you remember the days when you were searching for truth, searching for meaning, searching for a vocation, searching for a life mate? You remember all the turmoil of those days? The tragedy is that people get so used to their own day, they quit searching for things like that. I remember the intellectual pain of trying to find a place for myself in this world, trying to eliminate some option, searching for a way to find meaning and purpose with the few short years that I have here, not always certain that I know the truth or act appropriately. Where can I stand? Where should I not stand? How should I live? What should I not do? And I can't tell you the joy for some parameters, the joy of some do's and don'ts, the real meaning of Bob. Here is light. Walk in it, friend, and you'll find happiness and joy. Oh, the world is searching everywhere that usually focuses in on me. And here's a book that claims to be from God and focuses in on Him. I found myself in giving myself away to God. I could not find meaning and purpose as long as these few short years were for me. It's only when I saw something bigger and greater and more, it's only when I turned to others through Him, that life began to have the joy and meaning. It seems like that happiness, if you look for it, you can't find it. But if you try to help others, somehow it's in place. It's this special revelation. It's this book of books. You see, but Bob, the Bible has so many problems. The Bible's an Eastern book. It's written in Eastern thought forms and in Eastern literary devices. It is not a Western book. It does not match our view of how history ought to be written. It is not as precise as we want it to be. It is written in the language of phenomenological language, like the sun rises, the dead are buried. It's not in precise language. It's in metaphorical language. All of these things bother us because they're not the way our culture does it. But I want to say this to you. This is a trustworthy book. It is different from the way I would write about God and you would write about God. It is ancient, and we've lost some of its symbols, and we've lost some of the understanding of why they put it together this way. That is certainly true. But every time archaeology has dug up an ancient tale, the historicity of this book has been confirmed, even in areas where the Bible was the only witness in some areas to ancient peoples or places. And when archaeology finally discovered other witnesses, the Bible proved to be true. And if you doubt that, I just challenge you to look 50 years ago at the hair pull between the Bible's naming of Hittites as a major culture and the current level of scholarship. And they said the Bible is wrong and made up. And suddenly, in central Turkey, we found a library of 2,000 cuneiform tablets of the Hittite civilization. For years, the Bible in Daniel 5 was ridiculed because of Belshazzar's feast and the handwriting on the wall. Because we had a list of all the Babylonian kings in our documents, and Belshazzar wasn't on it. Nabonidus was Belshazzar's father, but not Belshazzar. And suddenly, more archaeological discoveries in Iran and Iraq have shown that Belshazzar's daddy left the city of Babylon, moved to the city of Tema, where his mother was the high priest of the moon god Zen, and left his son as co-regent in his place when the armies of Cyrus II approached that city. And nobody knew that until 70 years ago when those documents were found. The Bible was thought to be ridiculous in that. Every time, I challenge you to find one archaeological discovery that has shown this book not to be true. That ought to make you perk up. This book is the only ancient book I know that has predictive prophecy. If you look at the other holy books, the Quran does not have predictive prophecy that I know about. The Bhagavad Gita, the Rig Veda, the Upanishads, none of them that I know of, even when I've heard about prediction and I've tried to document it, I could not find it in the text. This book has precise predictions. Just do one. Bethlehem, Ephrathah, little among the clans of Judah, out of you will shine a great light. 750 years before the birth of Jesus, Micah chapter 5, verse 2, pick the village where the Messiah would be born. You say, but I just don't believe Isaiah spoke in 750. We know that the translation of the Greek from Hebrew to Greek was done in about 250 B.C. We still got a prediction longer than the history of the United States. Bethlehem was a town that had a filling station, police station, a post office, grocery store, all in one building. Little town. And this book pinpoints it. Hundreds of years. And it wasn't so easy for Jesus to get there either. Would you like to be on a donkey pregnant, moving 80 miles south? People say, well, Jesus just planned it out. What did he do? Kick prenatally south? The testimony of people across the years, from kings to peasants, lives have been permanently changed by reading this book and accepting its message. Permanently changed. You say, there's been some false people. Yes, there have. But the fact there are false people, and those who play the game, and those who don't hang in there, still does not reduce the evidence of the millions that have met him and never been the same again. This book is written over about 1,600 years in three languages and does not contradict itself. Yes, there are paradoxes. Yes, there are passages we don't understand. But this book does not contradict itself and has a unified message from people who are peasants to people who are kings, from people who are in Palestine to people who are in Mesopotamia writing this book, and it does not contradict itself. This is one awesome revelation. The evidence for its validity is overwhelming. I can't prove that the message is true, but all of these things point toward it. Matter of fact, I'd like to read you just a moment. You know, Psalms 119 is an acrostic of the letters of the Hebrew alphabet. Every paragraph starts with from the first to the last. There are 22 Hebrew alphabet letters. I just want to read you Mem and Nun. That's verse 97 through 112. Oh, how I love thy law. It is my meditation all day. Thy commandments make me wiser than my enemies, and they are forever mine. I have more insight than all my teachers, for thy testimonies are my meditation. I understand more than the aged, because I have observed thy precepts. I have restrained my feet from every evil way, that I have kept thy word. I have not turned aside from thy ordinances, for thou thyself taught me. How sweet are thy words to my taste, yes, sweeter than honey to my mouth. For thy precepts I get understanding, therefore I hate every false way. Thy word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path. I have sworn and I will confirm it, that I will keep thy righteous ordinances. I am exceedingly afflicted. Receive me, O Lord, according to thy word. Accept the freewill offering of my mouth, O Lord, and teach me thine ordinances. My life is continually in thy hand, yet I do not forget thy law. The wicked have laid a snare for me, yet I have not gone astray from thy precepts. I have inherited thy testimonies forever, for they are a joy to my heart. I have inclined my heart to perform thy statutes forever, even to the end. I am not 100% certain of anything in my world. I don't trust myself. I have to continue to pray, God, forgive me for the evil of my own heart. I have had to change my mind about theology. Some things I was taught did not hold water in face of the Bible. I've made mistakes in my interpretation of the Bible. Big mistakes that have led people astray. But when all is said and done, I am going to stand with this book until I breathe no more and I believe that Jesus is going to send somebody to get me. Herein is the truth for life. You have a choice. If you think it's not true, why don't you take a little time to search it out for yourself instead of just listening to someone else who poo-poos its message? Why don't you check out the prophecies and you look at the theories and you read about it? And if your life's not changed, then throw this book wherever you want to throw it. But I have found that this book is sharper than any two-edged sword when driven by the Spirit of God into the heart and soul of a hungry, sinful, lonely, purposeless world. I've got meaning. I've got joy. I've got guidance. I have some absolutes. And I sleep good at night. And if when I die, it's all proved to be a lie, I have had a wonderful life with this book. And I plan on having a wonderful afterlife with it too, thank you. I don't know a lot. I don't have perfect knowledge. I have a faith commitment. I don't have assurance beyond a reasonable doubt. I have a faith commitment based on the fact that this book has proven to be true historically, that when I met Christ, my life changed. And I've decided to walk hand in hand with the person I met in this book. And I have nothing more to confess to you with than this is a good book. And it can guide your hearts and minds, both here and in the hereafter. And if you don't know it or the hymn behind it, I challenge you to read it, to check it out, and then walk in the light you have. I grieve for my children, some God, that they're having to be exposed to so many views of reality, and yet I know it's just the Father in me. Worried that they may take a wrong step or get caught up in something weird and destructive, and yet, Father, you must have those same thoughts about me. I know that my theology is bad. I know my cosmology is fractured. I have no hope of having your mind. And yet you've given me freedom, God, to search and dream and plan and look and think. Thank you for the ability of our minds. Thank you that you're ready to meet us at every stage and in any place. I do not pray that you protect my kids from false views. I pray you'd equip them to know you. And God, I don't want them to know you just like I know you. I'm not committed to spit, dance, and chew or Southern Baptist or whatever. I'm committed to you. God, reveal yourself in powerful ways to this generation and to the generations that have seen been lost to the message. Forgive us that we think we're the only way when you're the only way. Forgive us for our dogmatism when sometimes it just screams of our ignorance. Help us to walk through life hand in hand with you. And hopefully, Lord, you're going to knock off the rough edges along the way. And I look forward to that day when the eastern skies open up and I get to go to a house prepared for me, your house. In Jesus' name, amen.